It is Friday, June 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the European Union and the United States extends their sanctions against Russia. A Maryland newspaper that was attacked by a gunman Thursday publishes an edition Friday.
I am blown away by the courage and fortitude of those journalists who are going back at it.
And school children in the U.S. are helping to save the monarch butterfly. It's all ahead. European leaders have agreed to extend their sanctions against Russia for its 2014 annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. The EU leaders said in a statement Friday the sanctions have been extended for 6 months. The French news agency AFP reported it had been told the decision was made at the leaders' summit in Brussels after they had a very short discussion on Ukraine. The United States, meanwhile, is also holding to sanctions against Russia for its 2014 annexation of the Crimean Peninsula. The U.S. intelligence community also concluded that Russia interfered in the 2016 U.S. presidential election to help Donald Trump win the White House. And special counsel Robert Mueller has already indicted Russian individuals and entities in a scheme to influence the vote. But as the date and venue for President Donald Trump's summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin were announced, the U.S. leader continued to dismiss allegations that Moscow interfered with his 2016 election. Spencer Boyer is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He tells International Edition's David Byrd, what the two leaders believe they will get out of the summit.
Well, I think both of them get a chance to try to change the subject and move beyond the friction of Russia's interference in the 2016 election and the storyline about Russian aggression in Ukraine. I think that the president has long wanted to reshape the narrative about Russia and turn it into something for political advantage here in the U.S. He just tweeted, Russia denies having anything to do with meddling in our election, and went on to rail against the FBI and Hillary Clinton. This, of course, outrages many Democratic officials and others in the U.S., but I think that the summit is yet another opportunity for him to try to change the storyline. He has also shown, of course, that he has an affinity for President Putin and his way of governing, and I think it's a chance for him to show the rest of the world that he can get something done when they can't.
This comes right after the NATO summit in Belgium, and the president at the last summit he attended, the G7, didn't sign the final declaration because of some remarks made by Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau. Yet when he met with Kim Jong-un, he surprised our allies by giving concessions on military exercises without consulting the South Koreans and the Japanese. Do you think that that kind of concession without consultation could come out of this meeting?
Absolutely. I think that Europeans and many others around the world do have the right to be nervous that we could have a repeat of performance of what we saw in Singapore with President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. You know, in that case, while Europeans are supportive, have been supportive of trying to get Kim to walk back his nuclear ambitions, there's a belief that Trump sought to get a quick fix for domestic political consumption, claiming victory while understating the long, difficult, substantive process ahead. And Kim got enhanced legitimacy without having to give hardly anything. So we could have a situation such as that, where you have Trump having a meeting with Putin and, you know, coming out of that with the aura of having been a great deal maker, having a political show for his domestic audience and saying, look, again, I was able to have this wonderful rapport with President Putin when no one else can do that. And Putin gets to claim that the efforts of the international community to isolate him haven't worked. He gets to replay video of President Trump praising him as a great leader, with whom he has wonderful rapport, who's being treated unfairly. And I think that this would certainly cause much further division with our allies and already divided alliance.
Spencer Boyer, a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Myanmar's democracy activists are breaking ranks with the NLD party. A candidate backed by President Trump, American Ken Isaacs, loses his bid to head the UN Migration Agency. The U.S. Defense Secretary meets with his Japanese counterpart, and Vietnam expects an economic boom from a trade deal with the European Union. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
An odd, rocky, cigar-shaped object called Oumuamua made news late last year when it was determined to be of interstellar origin. It was touted as our solar system's first visitor from another star system. At the time, scientists pegged Oumuamua as a comet. A few months later, studies indicated that it was instead an asteroid. Because of its origins and its odd appearance, word also started to spread that the object was actually an alien interstellar space probe. Now, after even more research, a team of astronomers have found that the object is moving faster than predicted, which to them suggests that Oumuamua is most likely a comet and not an asteroid. To make their findings, the astronomers analyzed data from both ground and space telescopes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, some American schoolchildren are working to protect the monarch butterfly. European Union leaders reached a deal early Friday morning on migration. The deal establishes reception centers for migrants and asylum seekers in EU member states that volunteer to have them. Georgina Wright is a research associate in the Europe program at the Chatham House think tank in London. I asked her if it's known how the agreement will work.
Heads of state and heads of government met for 2 days in Brussels to discuss lots of issues that are of concern to EU citizens, but one of the main ones, of course, was around the refugee crisis and how you could deal with it. To a certain extent, there was a breakthrough. There is a political agreement, at least amongst member states, that they're going to do more. So this includes setting up voluntary centres in those countries that are at the front line of receiving refugees, so that's Italy, Greece and Spain, but also in other member states, and also that they would be allocating more money to the Africa Fund, so around 500 million euros, to really address some of the root causes as well that is driving this migration to the EU.
Italy's new Prime Minister, Giuseppe Conte, he came to this meeting with some expectations, strong opinions, because there was just an election recently in Italy, and a number of voters there are concerned about the whole migration issue. How were his views imprinted on this particular agreement?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. I think this has been a major concern for Italy. Italy's obviously been at the front line of receiving many migrants and refugees from Africa, from the Middle East, and so they really wanted a European solution to this, and they've been crying out for one for the past couple of years. Now, I think a new Prime Minister can go back to Italy and say that he has managed to find a political agreement with other member states. So he'll be able to say that this is going to be an issue of concern, that the European Commission is going to be working on proposals on how you can really address that issue. But of course, the devil will be in the detail. You know, at the moment, these centres are very much would be operated on a voluntary basis. It's not entirely clear how they will be funded. It's also not entirely clear that they're going to speed up asylum processes. So, you know, it remains to be seen, I think.
And meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been under domestic pressure of her own. Mm. There are a number of elements within Germany. I mean, part of her coalition is concerned about the migrant crisis in that country. There's also a far-right faction. Mm-hmm. How does she view this entire issue?
Well, at the exit of the European Council, Angela Merkel said that, you know, it had been a very tough negotiation, but they did and had come to a solution. So I think she felt positive about that. Again, similarly to Italy, the devil will be in the details. So we will have to see how these centres will work in practice. you know, who's going to be designing them, who's going to fund them. But I think the Chancellor can go back to Germany reasonably optimistic that, you know, the EU are at least at this point together and willing to address this issue. Of course, she raised other issues that have not been resolved, such as creating centres outside of the EU, so in transit countries like in Libya, in Morocco. She mentioned that that would have to be done in cooperation with the UN, particularly the UNHCR. But again, we shall see. But I think at the moment it will be enough to satisfy her coalition and her electorate.
Georgina Wright, Research Associate in the Europe Program at Chatham House in London. Friday, a day after a gunman killed five of their colleagues, the staff of a U.S. newspaper published a new edition reporting the horrifying events that unfolded in their newsroom less than 24 hours earlier. The front page headline of the Capital Gazette, based in Annapolis, Maryland, read, "Five shot dead at the Capitol." Reporters covered the story, some telling their personal experiences during the shooting. Jared Ramos was charged Friday with five counts of first-degree murder, according to online court records. President Donald Trump spoke at the White House about the shootings.
"This attack shocked the conscience of our nation and filled our hearts with grief. Journalists, like all Americans, should be free from the fear of being violently attacked while doing their job."
Anne Arundel County Police Chief Timothy Altomare spoke Friday to the news media.
"This was a targeted attack. We can't fathom why that person chose to do this. We don't think we have any more clear and present dangers to the citizens of Anne Arundel County. That person has had a history with the Anne Arundel County Police Department."
Rebecca Snyder is the executive director of the Maryland-Delaware District of Columbia Press Association. She gives me her reaction to the attack against the Capital Gazette.
As a whole, our membership is shocked. They're horrified. We're a very small, cohesive community of journalists in this region, and many of our members have worked alongside the victims. I think it really hits so close to home because every newsroom has, you know, that disgruntled person that maybe isn't letting coverage go or feels maligned. And, you know, the alleged shooter had a history with that newsroom for almost a decade. But everyone has a history like that with someone, some member of the community. And it doesn't stop our journalists from doing their jobs, from going to work, from reporting on the issues that are critical to the communities that they serve. And so it's heartbreaking, it's devastating, and I am blown away by the courage and fortitude of those journalists who are going back at it. You know, in the moments after the shootings, there were tweets coming out of that newsroom. They were covering the whole incident as a story, even though people that they've worked alongside with for decades in some cases were killed. And that is amazing to me.
Yeah, and they published today, Friday.
Absolutely. And that is what journalists do. You know, community journalism is the backbone here. And you heard it from the police lieutenant who recognized that, you know, they talk to reporters and editors from the Capital Gazette every day. No, they have deep, deep ties to the community. And of course they get the paper out because that's what journalists do. But it's not easy. It's not a walk in the park. And I think they need so much support now and going into the future. Once that adrenaline wears off, it's a long, long process.
For those listeners that live overseas, which is a lot of our audience, Annapolis is the capital, the state capital of Maryland, and the Capital mm-hmm. Gazette is the paper there. You know, looking forward, do you think news organizations need to think about tightening security in the future?
It is a real catch-22 because newspapers and news media organizations are meant to be really localized within their communities. And in order to report on the news, you have to interact with the community. You have to be a part of it. You have to be there. But across the U.S., you are seeing that nowhere is safe. You know, these shootings have happened in churches, in schools, certainly in workplaces. And so balancing how you keep your people safe and how you do your job, that conversation is cropping up everywhere in the U.S. I do know that some of our members had already undergone active shooter trainings, drills, things of that nature, and those are strategic and smart things to do. But I don't know if I don't make those decisions for our members on how they handle security. But I do know that the Annapolis Capital Gazette was very close. They were on a ground floor. There's no security to get in aside from the front desk as you come in through reception. So it is very porous because by design, community journalism is porous.
Rebecca Snyder, the executive director of the Maryland-Delaware District of Columbia Press Association. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's Newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Many elementary schools around the United States have started gardens to give their young students a chance to get hands-on experience with growing and eating vegetables, learning about nutrition and nature in the process. The Ecology Club at P.B. Smith Elementary School in Warrington, Virginia, started its garden a couple of years ago. And as Faiza Al-Masri tells us, the school's beautiful, well-kept green space got a valuable addition last year, a garden filled with plants that attract butterflies. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Keely Scott has always been involved in school activities and clubs. Last year, the high school junior needed a project for her Girl Scout club. She went back to her old elementary school, P.B. Smith, and created a butterfly garden.
We had a butterfly bush in my house, and we actually had to cut it down when we built our deck, and I missed it so much, and I loved looking at all the butterflies, and I was like, wow, well, we have a decreased population in our area, and I thought, oh, well, I can fix that. So I developed this idea, and Miss Denise supported me 100%.
Barbara Denis is the Ecology Club teacher.
One of our missions for the Ecology Club is to be good stewards of the earth. And they can say those words, but they don't really understand them until they actually do something.
Does anybody know what that is going to turn into? I know we said swallowtail, but do you know
tiger
what a
swallowtail?
Tiger swallowtail. What colors?
Black.
It would be
orange.
Orange. Now you're thinking of monarch, but it's a yellow. It's got some black and yellow, even a little bit of.
It is. It
is right. It's our state insect.
In the school's garden, kids help plant, grow, and harvest a variety of herbs and vegetables. They give part of the produce to the school's cafeteria and donate the rest to a local food bank. In the butterfly garden, they learn about butterflies.
We talk about the need for a certain plant for an organism to survive. We talk about the cycles because we've got eggs, we've got our larva, caterpillar, and then we've got this chrysalis, and then they're waiting patiently for it to emerge.
The students' patience was rewarded when monarch butterflies landed in their garden. Monarchs lay their eggs only on milkweed plants, which have been disappearing due to the use of herbicides and weather conditions. That means monarchs have fewer places to stop on their migration journey between Canada and Mexico.
We had probably about a dozen monarchs come, and in years past we've never had any. So we feel like we have definitely been a good station for the monarchs. And then once they emerge from their chrysalis, then they fly away, and they know where to go. That's amazing. They know where to go. I don't know how to get to Mexico, but they do. And they follow the sun. And the kids had helped in that. All right, be gentle. Be gentle. Because they've only laid their eggs recently, so they aren't mature enough. They're going to be really gentle.
Keenan Whitney says he gets so excited that he tells his family all about what he learns in the garden.
I only thought they pollinated one flower for some reason, but then I learned that they pollinated a lot of flowers.
They'll be butterflies soon, but they have to be as big as, say, that.
Are there any in here?
11-year-old Amelia Jacob says every time she and her classmates visit the butterfly garden, they learn something new and amazing.
We saw several swallowtails caterpillars, and there's this really fat one that should be turning into a chrysalis soon. I'm quite surprised at how it can turn into a chrysalis, and then just how does its body form into the beautiful body of a butterfly.
School principal Linda Payne Smith says she loves hearing comments like that.
We want the kids to take ownership of those gardens and come back, just like our senior Keeley Scott has come back and created the butterfly garden. We hope that their love for the environment started at PB Smith, and we have seen it evolve. And so our hope is that it will continue.
While they're getting excited about gardening and closely watching the butterfly's cycle of life, the kids realize they're doing something to help their communities. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Thank you, Faith. That is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Cuban government continues to imprison critics of the communist regime. The United States, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert, reiterates its deep concern for political prisoners in Cuba. The cases of Dr. Ariel Ruiz Urquiola and Dr. Eduardo Cardet, both of whom have been declared prisoners of conscience by a prominent human rights organization, are just two examples of how the Cuban government continues to silence the peaceful opposition of its own citizens. Human rights activist Dr. Cardet is serving a 3-year sentence for allegedly criticizing former Cuban leader Fidel Castro. In May, Cuban authorities told his family they would not be allowed to visit him in jail for 6 months as a punishment for his family's efforts to raise awareness of his case internationally. Also last month, a court in Cuba sentenced scientist and environmental activist Dr. Ruiz Urquiola to a year in prison for allegedly disrespecting government authority. Cuban government officials have harassed Dr. Ruiz Urquiola for years for speaking out on environmental issues. Ms. Nauert said, "We are deeply troubled by reports that he is currently on a hunger strike and in a critical medical condition." According to the most recent State Department human rights report, the exact number of political prisoners in Cuba was difficult to determine, though independent human rights organizations recently estimated there were more than 120 political prisoners. The government denies holding any political prisoners and refuses access to its prisons and detention centers by international humanitarian organizations and the United Nations. This lack of governmental transparency, along with systemic violations of due process rights, obfuscates the true nature of criminal charges, investigations, and prosecutions, allowing government authorities to prosecute and sentence peaceful human rights activists for criminal violations. The government uses the designation of quote-unquote counter-revolutionary for inmates deemed to be political opposition, but does not publicize those numbers. The United States calls on the government of Cuba to release all political prisoners immediately and to stop its arbitrary detention of Cuban activists and independent thinkers who criticize their government through peaceful means. The Cuban government must also cease its reprisals against the family members of these activists.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Of information.